Welcome to the Ferris Love Podcast. Here we explore spiritual insights and practical strategies to help you cultivate a family life rooted in beautiful, self-giving love. Join us as we invite experts to share uplifting perspectives and actionable advice for navigating the joys and challenges of modern family dynamics. Welcome back to the Ferris Love Podcast. Today, we have a very special guest, the CEO of the Ferris Love Family Project, JL Marti. He is going to speak with us about vocation and how parents can truly help cultivate an openness to God's will for their children. So JL, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you, Mary Grace. I'm very, very happy to be with you here.
So this is a very exciting topic, and I would just love it if you could just share a little bit with us about kind of your background, where you grew up, and what your childhood was like.
All right. Well, just maybe I could start with the present. I'm now living in Los Angeles, and I love it here because I love the ocean, I love the mountains, and I love the weather. And it's actually, for me, it's a little bit like coming back to my roots because I'm from Granada, Spain, originally. And Granada has a very Mediterranean weather, which is what Los Angeles has. The topography and the mountains is very similar. I grew up in Granada and a very normal family, you know, loving family. My parents both were Catholics, as was pretty much everybody in that country at that time. I was born in the late 60s, 1969, as a matter of fact. And then after some time in Spain, I moved to the U.S. to go to college. When I was 19, I went to Houston, where I stayed for 30-some years before moving to California. And, you know, a little bit about me. I love sports. I'm a fanatic of soccer, and especially of some teams that my friends know very well. I won't mention it so not to disappoint the other half of the world that likes the other team, certain soccer team in Spain. And I also like to practice them. I do triathlons. Being in California has enabled me to do even more so because the weather is awesome and the terrain is fantastic. So I do what we call half Ironman, or 70.3 Ironman. And I'm an engineer by training, and I also have an MBA. But in the last 25 years, I've been working mostly in formation of young people, and also formation of young adults, married men, within the context of Opus Dei. I'm a numerary in Opus Dei. I think you may have mentioned that. Yeah, so I don't know if that's enough for my background.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, well, let's just go a little bit deeper into that. So can you please explain to us, for listeners who may not be familiar with Opus Dei, can you tell us a little bit about what that is and in regards to within the church?
Sure. So exactly. So I start with what you just said. Opus Dei is a part of the Catholic Church. And I would say Opus Dei shares with the rest of Catholics about 99% of what we stand for, what we do, what we love. So we love the Mass and the sacraments. We pray to Mary. We have a great devotion and love for her. When I say we, I'm not talking on behalf of Opus Dei, but I am in Opus Dei, and this is what I have experienced throughout my life. Charity is the top virtue, and we try to love and understand everybody, and we try to be sowers of peace and joy, is what our founder, Saint Jose Maria, said. And then within the church, and within this Christian spirit of love and kind of reaching out to everybody, the specific thing about Opus Dei is that God is interested in my daily life, in my family life, my work, my friendships, my sports, you know, my everything. And I can reach a great friendship with God, with Jesus Christ, with our Holy Mother, precisely in those circumstances, in those things, in those moments of the day. And Opus Dei provides, first of all, the message to raise awareness about that within the Catholic Church, but also it provides you the means. They provide accompaniment, formation, training, coaching, one-on-one, in groups, with classes and retreats and workshops, so that you can actually achieve that goal, which is to be very close to God as you live your normal life as a Catholic, as a lay Catholic. The majority of Opus Dei members are married, and the majority of people who benefit from Opus Dei are married with their families. And then there's a few of us who are celibate, and we are available to help the others more, right? Because we don't have our own families, so we are here to help many other families. That's in a nutshell, I think, what Opus Dei is.
Excellent. And how did you kind of learn about it? How did this come into your life? I mean, is it something that's everywhere, you know, everywhere, or, you know, how did you first learn about it?
So obviously it was started in Spain, right? Santa Maria was a Catholic priest in Spain who had this idea and vision from God, you know, to help people to find God in their ordinary lives. And he created a way to do that. It's not just that he had an idea, but he actually worked hard in his entire life to make it happen, to help people grow in that aspect. So my family got to know Opus Dei because we were looking for a school. My dad was a judge. Okay. And in Spain, pretty much when you're a judge, you study law and then you take a big exam and it's very hard to get into. But once you get in, what you do is you go to small towns and be a judge there. And then with seniority, you can go to bigger towns. And our goal was always to go back to Granada. And then when my dad finally got the job as a judge in Granada, and then we were looking for a school. And I remember I was 6 years old, and my parents were told about this school that is entrusted to Opus Dei, the formation of spiritual care, and these parents are starting, and it was a new thing. So it wasn't very, it didn't have a track record, let's put it that way, but it seemed like a great thing. And then I remember attending that school, and my mom eventually, I started noticing she started going to daily mass, and then my dad, and my mom was a pharmacist, an entrepreneur, actually. So she studied pharmacy, and when she got married and started having kids, she didn't finish college. But then when my youngest brother, there's five of us, I'm the third in five. My youngest brother, who's 4 years younger than me, was born, and he was like, I think, probably four or so. My mom went back to college and finished the pharmacy and then got her own pharmacy. So both my parents were working as I grew up, my late teens. And after attending the school, eventually they found out about a summer camp. So I started going to a summer camp organized by Opus Dei people. And that led to me, when I was in high school, attending activities at a local Opus Dei center. So I'm being familiar with many of my friends went to that center, and I made lifelong friendships from that school and from that experience.
So you mentioned earlier in that you were a numerary, and then there's also the married people. So you're celibate, and then there's also the married individuals that are also in the work. Can you explain to us a little bit about, like, what was that process like to discern?
Okay. Yeah. So the majority of Opus Dei members are married. And they live with their families, wherever, you know, their families live. And some of them are husbands, wives, some of them are grandparents, or some of them are younger, and there are, you know, children in those families. You have to be 18 at least to be in Opus Dei. You have to be an adult. Mm-hmm. But the way I came to think about Opus Dei was, first of all, I was familiar with numeraries because I used to go to the center, and also in the summer camps, you know, they always help with the staffing and different things. There were other people there too, but the numerals were part of that. And I was very friendly with them. And it kind of felt like I was part of that family. And they were part of my family. My parents would invite them over to watch a soccer game or to have dinner. And so they were in and out of my house. I was in and out of the center of Opus Dei. But I always thought that my calling was actually at the beginning. I wanted to be like my dad. I wanted to be a supernumerary, and I wanted to have a good family. Part of the reason was that actually my two older siblings decided to discern a vocation to be numeraries themselves. And at present, all five of us are numeraries, actually. And that's something that it's really, really, I'm so grateful for that. I give thanks to God every day, and I pray for them. And it's a wonderful thing, I can tell you that. But back then I thought, well, I think my mom and my dad, they want to have grandchildren, so I'm going to be the one that it's going to make that happen. But then one of the fellows that I knew there, one of my best friends, popped the question, said, hey, listen, I think it's great that you are in love with Opus Dei and you've been coming around and you benefited, you're praying a lot, you're happy, you have many friends that you're trying to help and do well in your studies and so on. Just one objective fact, you know, is that there are many supernumeraries, but then they're not as many numeraries. So actually numeraries are needed. So if you think that you could actually do that for God, why don't you pray about it? And so I prayed about it, and I discerned, and I was very scared. And it wasn't all like one day. I had to dedicate time to do that, to pray. But in the end, I decided I want to do this. And And I can tell you, I mean, actually, there was a time when I had a lot of doubts and I kind of went back, and I can talk about that too. But I have been very, very happy in my life. And I'm very, very grateful to God for giving me this call.
And such a, I mean, that's pretty profound to have a friend ask that question, you know, like just to make you think a little bit more about things, you know?
Yeah. No, and obviously I have thought about it myself, seeing my siblings, you know, being numerous. And I was very happy. I was very good friends with my siblings. Mm-hmm. Especially my brother, who's older than me, because my younger brothers came along and my mom wanted me to be out of the house so that she could take care of the two younger ones. So he would always send me with my older brother to do things with her friend, his friends, and so on. So, and he was very patient with me. You know, I'm three years younger than him, and he never objected. He always had, you know, took care of me with his friends. And anyway, so when he became a numerary, it was a very impactful moment for me, right? But I can also tell you that so the first years that you are in Opus Dei as a numerary, mm-hmm. typically you're very young, right? You are 18, you're 20. Mm-hmm. And what you do is, and actually even before that, you can actually try to live as a numerary, even though, again, you cannot join Opus Dei until 18. But so your life is very much as a student surrounded by young people. And when you become a numerary, you are helping especially your friends and that group of people. And then you grow up with the idea of helping the youth. And those are it's a lot of fun, and it's very, very rewarding as well. So it's to teach young people the first devotions, to teach young people how to be really loyal friends, to teach young people how to live a clean life, you know, that is full of happiness. And especially nowadays, it's a big challenge, right? We're being attacked from all angles. So that is very, very rewarding. But then I was thinking, well, when I grow older in Opus Dei as a numerary, I'm going to have to move on from this, you know, and I won't be able to hang out with young people. I'll have to go with the older folks. I was afraid of that. But now that I've done it for about almost 8 years, working with young dads, working with adult men, helping them with their families, and learning from my experience of 25 years working with young people, I mean, being young myself and growing up, it has been even more rewarding. I'm happier. I've been happy in Opus Dei since day one, but I am happier now. I'm happier every day. And why do I say this? Because I see husbands who have had a difficult relationship with their wives improve over time, thanks also to the fact that they talk to me and I give them advice and encouragement. I have seen families that suddenly they have two or three more children, and they have told me, you know why? This is because this fellow, and you know, then they tell me the name of a numerary, he's been talking to me and he's encouraged me to have more children, and I couldn't be more happy now having these two or three more children that I have now. It's helping people in all kinds of circumstances, you know, sometimes with substance abuse, sometimes with, and it's amazing how much they trust you, they open up, and you're there to help them. And that is, I mean, I wouldn't trade that for anything, you know.
Yeah.
So that's part of being a numerary.
Yeah, and that's very powerful too. Like you had said earlier, you mentioned how you have more time to do that because you're giving your family life is with, you know, the other numeraries and things like that. So that's
exactly
very powerful for giving your time in that way.
So being a numerary, you have your job, which you do. And I have worked as an engineer for many years. Mm-hmm. But you also have time, you know, in the evenings and the weekends. And so you dedicate time to study. You study a lot of philosophy, theology, just to really have more conviction about the faith. You know, I believe in Jesus Christ, I believe in the church, I believe in God, but there are degrees of believing, right? Like, can you say that, would you put your hand on the fire for this idea? And I would. I mean, I hope, thanks be to God and with his help. But it's also because I have studied and I have seen the alternatives and I have pondered and thought with many people. And then not to let that stay with me, but to give to others the reassurance that even though there's evil and there's suffering in the world, there's meaning. And God loves each one of us unconditionally. And we had to love each other. What we had to mimic that, try to. So all of that I can do because I have the time. and the company of other numerics and the support of Opus Dei to do that. So that's why it makes, and to say, when I first joined Opus Dei, my big fear was, well, I think that to be happy, I have to date and I have to find a girl that would be my companion for life. And I had to start a family with them, with her, because I wanted to replicate what I had lived in my house with my parents. Mm-hmm. Believe me, my parents are wonderful people, but they couldn't be more different from each other. They have very different temperaments. My dad was more in the humanities. My mom was in science. My mom is type A, like achiever. She's a leader, you know. And my dad was a lot more patient and mindful of things and kind of subdued. So it's not that they didn't have arguments or different opinions many times, but they had this common understanding, this set of values that was a huge foundation for them and that made my childhood very secure, you know, in that I knew that I could count on them, I could talk to them, and they were very open. And I remember my dad talking to me, for example, about the facts of life when I was very young, when I had my first questions about that. But I remember my mom, I'll mention this now, because after being a numerary for a year or two, you know, or starting my process, I really had doubts, you know, and I was, in the back of my mind, was this girl that I knew and that I liked, and I said, well, I can have a life that I would be very happy with her, and I think she would with me. So I kind of took some months to pray about it and think about it. And I started not going to the center of Opus Dei as much and hanging out more with my friends. And I would still pray, you know, but not to the degree that I was doing it before. And it was at that time that I opened up to my mom. And my mom told me very clearly, you know, do whatever you want to. You know, God is happy with you being a supernumerary, being a numerary. As long as you are close to him, just do whatever you want. And actually that attitude from my mom, who was a member of Opus Dei and very enthusiastic about it, helped me to relax and to see things with more perspective. And also the grace of God. I mean, obviously there was that I think I want to do this, you know, and I came back even with more strength, and I have looked back ever since. So that sense of freedom and understanding and unconditional acceptance of what I wanted, because I was her son from my mom, actually taught me a lot about how God behaves with each one of us. So
Wow.
I don't know. I've gone in a tangent, but
no, that actually has gone right onto my those questions. Yeah, of just, were there any fears? I love that you mentioned your mom's support, and I'm sure your dad was supportive as well. And did you find that in the midst of kind of just living out this vocation, that were people like understanding of it, or were they confused? How did you go about navigating that? You know, because it's unique, so, I would say. Wouldn't you say it's pretty unique?
Yeah, there is Opus Dei. I think it's one of the first institutions in the church that has a vocation for lay people, right? It's not an association that you join or where you go and spend some time there and you try to give them money and sometimes you volunteer a few hours. It's actually a calling that affects everything that you do. And you look at it, everything in life, through that prism of, I am a son of God or a daughter of God. And God wants to have this very close relationship with me. Because why? Because I'm a baptized Catholic. I belong in the church. I have the sacramental seal of being a son of God or a daughter of God. And I want to live that in everything I do in my life. And that's kind of the message of Opus Dei, is that ordinary Catholics are called to be as holy as priests and nuns and everybody else. And we love the priests and we love the religious people in the church and the consecrated and the priests. But most of us are lay people, most of Catholics. So everybody's called to have a close relationship, friendship with God. Sometimes Opus Dei is looked at, you know, with suspicion, or because it's a new thing and it's different and it's hard to put us. And sometimes ourselves, we have not done ourselves any favors by kind of being a little bit too reserve about talking about our experience in Opus Dei, our vocation. Mm-hmm. Part of it because the vocation itself is very ordinary, you know, and there's nothing remarkable. So, I mean, there's not much of a story, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But at the same time, I think that now there's an effort to, we don't want to be perceived as secrets.
Mm-hmm.
Or we want to be out there and tell the people who we are, because there's nothing to be, I mean, everything is very good, you know? So
yeah.
At the same time, I would say that for young people, especially considering the vocation to Opus Dei as a numerary, I think that it is normal for them to feel, I mean, the fear, you know, or the apprehension that, am I really going to do the right thing here? Or am I making a mistake that I might regret later or whatever? And I think that we've learned in Opus Dei to accompany people better in this process of discernment. Part of it is through the teaching of Pope Francis, right? Our late Pope, who has insisted on this. And that has done a great service to the church and to Opus Dei. We are very grateful to people who try to be in Opus Dei, so to speak, or who try a vocation in Opus Dei, and then they don't continue for some reason. And they are welcome to stay in touch and to read information, and later on they can join Opus Dei as supernumeraries, for example. Mm-hmm. And before, that was a thing that it was a little bit more complicated. So it was different times in the church and different approaches, but I think that this is very, very positive.
That's great.
But like I said, I think the main thing is to understand it's very hard for a young person to know my life can have huge consequences in helping other people. And I don't have to be a priest or a nun or anything to be that. If I am committed to giving God my time, my attention, my love, God will use me as an instrument to help many people. But I cannot do it just on my own, right? It's not that I have within myself everything that I need. No, I need to learn from the experience of the church, from the gospel, from the life of Jesus and the saints. I need to be formed. I need to be informed. I need to be trained. And that's what Opus Dei provides. And there are many other ways in the church that you can get that training. And so to each his own, right? But for me, the spirituality of Opus Dei is, you know, obviously that's why I'm here. I love it. And I think a lot of people, if they look into it, it can also be very important and helpful mm-hmm. for their lives.
Mm-hmm. It's very approachable, considering like it's about the ordinary. It's about your day to day. You had mentioned that you're an engineer, but you do serve, you know, in the sense of like formation and all that for young men and for families. Yeah. Are numeraries only those people that give formation, or you know, are they also out in the world doing?
No, numeraries, like the rest of people in Opus Dei who are of working age, right? There are many people who are retired in Opus Dei and they don't work anymore. They're retired. But like my mom, for example.
Yeah.
But numeraries have, most of the time, they have a job, right? They have mm-hmm. a professional career. I know some numeraries who are doctors. Many of them are teachers. Mm-hmm. Some of them are lawyers. There's an accountant. And numeraries live in centers. Typically, they live in centers of Opus Dei with other numeraries, and they live family life, what we call. You know, Opus Dei is a family within the church, and that local center provides that formation and that point of support and accompaniment for many people who are in the city, you know, throughout the city. Like it happens in Los Angeles. In Los Angeles, there's two centers. One is close to UCLA, and another one is closer to downtown.
Mm-hmm.
We have people in Opus Dei, and then many, many friends, right? People in Opus Dei are only a tiny fraction of the people that are affected by Opus Dei, because there's many friends and cooperators and families that are in touch as far as San Diego, Orange County, Las Vegas. So what I'm saying is they're even hours apart from the center, but they still get help and nourishment from the fact that some people here are trying to live this commitment to learn so that they are able to help other people. Do this fantastic thing of finding God in ordinary lives, right?
Yeah, that's beautiful. I want to go back to just what your thoughts are with your parents, because this podcast is for parents and families. And
yes,
I would love to hear what your thoughts are on just how your parents kind of laid that foundation for you to be able to consider even this being a vocation, or like to open up your heart to discerning this is an option that God, you know, might want for me.
So, you know, I've wondered about that myself. And I asked my mom, you know, because again, the fact that there's five of us and all five of us are numeric in Opus Dei.
Mm-hmm.
And we're, like I said, we are very normal. We all thought, I mean, I've known the young men that my sisters, who's the oldest, was interested in. And then the women, the young girls, that my brothers have been interested in. I myself, you know, had sort of like a girlfriend and so on. So we're very normal, but we all decided to be numeraries. And I think part of this, what my mom told me is, first of all, we have loved you a lot. Mm-hmm. So I think that the foundation of any parenting has to be unconditional love. You know, I'm going to love you trying to imitate what God does for us, which is unconditional love. Then together with that, I think that I remember my dad coming from work every day and sitting down in a, and I remember the corner of the house where he would sit down and read the Bible every day. Every day, you know. Maybe weekends it was different, Saturdays and Sundays, because he didn't come from work. So I don't know. I remember coming from work before dinner and reading the Bible. Then I remember my mom, for example, teaching me prayers. We would, of course, go to Mass on Sundays with them. But I remember after I made my first communion, she would teach me some prayers to say after Mass, you know, in Thanksgiving after communion. Mm-hmm. And at the beginning, she didn't do that. Like, she would say, I'm going to stay here and give thanks to God. Why don't you guys go outside and play there? In Spain, typically in front of the church, there's always a square, you know, so people, the young people can play and all that. Mm-hmm. But at one point, my mom told me, well, if you want to stay, why don't you stay and pray with me? And she showed me the prayers of the Anima Christi, or the prayer before Jesus crucified, or the self-offering in St. Ignatius. And those were powerful prayers for me to pray when I was in my teens, you know, kind of accepting God into my life in a personal way, not just, you know, what we did as a group of people in Mass. I also remember praying the rosary when we were in the car, and we would pray the rosary, and it was funny because we would, you know, the children were in the back seat, and we would pray, and then one of us would fall asleep. And then we would elbow each other, hey, wake up. And then my mom would look back and say, no, let them sleep, they're tired. You know, they don't have to pray now, they can pray later. We'll pray for them. So that also taught me how God is, you know, that God is very loving, you know, and that he's not demanding like, no, pray now and this way and so on. But there's a lot of ways of doing things, you know, and there's a lot of ways to reach God and to pray, and he adapts to our lives. At the same time, that was a testimony that they were people of prayer. They were also people who work hard. As I mentioned, my mom was a pharmacist, and my dad was a judge. And I remember finishing homework next to my dad as he would write his opinions at home. Or I remember helping my mom by going to the pharmacy there and taking care of some of the chores that would put the medicines in the shelves. So my mom would always make us our bed in the morning and put our clothing at night, hang it and fold it and so on. So little ways that go into, I don't know, developing virtue in little people, you know, being patient, but at the same time being demanding, and above all, being very, very loving. I mean, I think that that's what I remember from my childhood. And what I think it was very instrumental in making me the person that I am today.
That's great. I'm curious, what would you suggest for parents? You mentioned love. I love that. That was the best thing, love. And then, kind of showing your children in the sense of, like, how to live a close life to Christ, you know, through prayers, through Thanksgiving. How can families continue to cultivate that mindset of, you know, your vocation could be, I mean, to be marriage, but then also it could be to celibacy. It could be to, you know, this possibility of giving yourself fully to God. Like, how would you suggest parents go about kind of incorporating that into their family life?
So I think, first of all, the first thing is example, which is what I mentioned about my dad and my mom, right? So they tried to, first of all, they were living that which then I realized was a close friendship with Christ. But I could also sense it overall in the whole spirit of the family and how we've organized our time, or our, you know, we celebrated Christmas, we celebrated Holy Week and Easter. Whenever there was a piece of bad news, we would try to gather and pray. So the trust in God and the love for God was kind of, my parents passed it on to us because they was there all the time, right? Even if it was making us a little snack or dinner, or breakfast, it was, we would say a blessing before every meal, but it was more the attitude with which they did things, you know, with that spirit of service, always trying to be cheerful. And again, they had problems. I remember one of my uncles had the unfortunate situation where he actually had an accident when he was young, and when my aunt was young, and my cousins were very young, and it was a tragedy in the family. And it was shocking, you know, as a child to hear that. You know, why would God allow this? And that kind of thing. And I remember my mom, first of all, leaving the family right away to be with her sister, you know, accompany them, even though it was a long trip. But it was also The reaction was, well, God knows more. God knows something good will come from this. So we had to accept it. I mean, we're nobody to judge God. And this is life. And now is the time to help a lot, your siblings, your cousins and your aunt. But it's from that point of view, absolute trust in God and his providence. Mm-hmm. I think also for my parents, I learned friendship. And we would have friends all the time and do plans with friends, you know, family plans. I was very good friends with my siblings. We would play all kinds of games, board games, soccer. We would watch movies. To be interested in others, to have friendships, to bring people into the house who are passing on those good values as well. And like I said, we had people from Opus Dei coming to my house from the center, all the new marriage. You know, they were kind of part of the family in a way, you know, and in a very informal way, nothing kind of out of the ordinary. Mm-hmm. But you want to expose your children to that kind of environment so that then they can think for themselves, hey, I think this is something that I will role model. I like to explore, you know. Mm-hmm. And then the idea of freedom, I think, is very important. I mentioned that earlier, that how my mom's sense of freedom when I had a crisis in my vocation helped me a lot to actually not get nervous about it and not try to make any, I don't know, quit decisions, but to take my time, and I came out of it. You know, I think parents need to be very respectful also, especially when the children are older and they have to respect that they're going to make mistakes and they're going to learn from them and not to be afraid that everything has to be perfect. Everything is not perfect. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's fine.
Yeah, that's great. And you said you worked with young men in regards to, like, for the past 25 years, you had said, and then you switched over to kind of older fathers. Yeah. And all that. What would you say to a young adult who is kind of, who's considering this vocation and they're just kind of stuck or they're nervous, or, I mean, kind of like what you had mentioned, what your mom said about God wants you to desire, but do you have anything else that you would say to them to help them in that discernment?
I mean, the first thing is my fears, my being afraid of embarking in this type of vocation were very strong at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And later on, they were present at times, you know, in my late teens, my teens, up to my 30s, I think, you know, my early 30s. Mm-hmm. But I think it's normal in young people to have, you know, to feel the blues from time to time, no matter what you do, right? That sometimes you feel like, well, so-and-so is happier than I am, or if I had done this or that, well, this afternoon, I feel kind of a little bit tired or lonely or sad. It's normal to feel that way, you know, from time to time. But what helped me was to see how people that I loved and trusted a lot were there to encourage me, to help me, on the one hand, make free decisions. On the other hand, challenge me and tell me, you know, with God's help, you can do everything. And as long as it's a prudent thing, you have to think about it. You have to, do I really have what it takes? You know, do I have the capacity, the qualities to lead that kind of life? Can I be a good friend? Can I pray? Can I sustain this for some time? So I think the decision has to be based on reality, but also on the advice that you get from people who are familiar with you and who love you. Mm-hmm. And that played a huge role in my discernment. In the end, it has to be you. And that's why discerning in Opus Dei, but also in the church, it's not a matter of a day or even a week or even a month. It takes years, right? And it's sort of like when you get married, you don't get married the day after you meet your spouse, right? I mean, you kind of have a period of courtship. And you, mm-hmm. But once you get married, it gets kind of serious, right? It's a sacrament, you know, and you've given your work to God and that person. So it's the same thing in Opus Dei. It takes years. And there's a lot of freedom and an abundance of formation, reaching my heart, in, you know, enlightening my intellect to know the truth and to know the reason for things. Another thing that I think is very important, and I realized eventually, which prompted me to say yes, was I am needed. Mm-hmm. Okay, there's a lot of things that are not going well in the world, and there are many people who don't really understand or for whatever reason love Christ and the church. So there's only few of us. Well, I wouldn't say there's few of us, but there are not that many who are willing to put everything on the line for our Lord, you know, and to give him a blank check. So we need people who are able to take that risk. Believe me, you know, and I have, after talking to many young people who are married now and they're having one, two, three, kids, being married is, I think it's a bit more difficult than being single, a celibate like myself. Mm-hmm. You know, I think at the beginning, when you're in your 20s, it's more difficult to be a numerary than a supernumerary because of those challenges, emotional challenges that you always needed. You thought you needed a girlfriend and a wife and kids. But later on, being married and giving yourself to your wife and your kids and your children and enduring with them the things that life throws at you, sometimes disease, sometimes setbacks, sometimes lack of understanding and, you know, and problems and arguments and so on. It is hard. So life is going to be hard no matter what we plan for ourselves. The point is, are you willing to embrace those times of suffering and pain with God and with Christ? Are you going to find the meaning in them by your life of prayer and your support that you get from other people and your conversation with other good people that give you good advice? And then you're able to do anything and be happy as you do it. You might be suffering, but you're going to be happy. I think that's a long answer, but all of those things go that's what I would tell young people nowadays, you know, that you are needed. God needs you. The church needs you. And you have to figure out how you can. So, but always knowing you're free and God leaves us free. God is never going to kind of make it so sure and that he's going to not able to, that he's going to make us have to do something. You know, there's always a degree of, I have to, yeah, I think God is calling me to this, but I have to actually want to do it, you know, by knowing how good it is and then informing myself, I have to want to be able to do it. God is never going to force me to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's great. And what gives you kind of the most hope? This is kind of our last question, but what gives you the most hope for the future of family and family life?
So I think that being in touch with so many young people who love, who are pining for a meaningful family life, who want to give themselves to their spouses. In my case, I deal mostly with men, right? So to their wives and their children, you know, and who are patiently, day by day, feeding their kids, changing diapers, having the patience to teach them to pray at night, and knowing that every day counts, every hour counts in the formation of their children. But these are people who are very busy professionally. They may be having a big time job and so on, but they go home and they become humble and they are not afraid or too busy to spend time playing with their 2-year-old, 3-year-old, and cooking dinner or helping their wives cook. Or that gives me a lot of hope, you know, because that is where I live. I asked my mom recently, did dad ever change my diapers, or did he give me the bottle? And my mom told me, you know, your dad loved you very much, but it was different. There were different times. Your dad never changed your diapers, never give you the bottle. It was different. So what I see now is that young men who are married, they're willing to do that. You know, I mean, they're very happy doing so. And it's probably because the expectation is such that, you know, that's going to happen. But that is going to be the foundation for a lifelong friendship with their children. That is going to be so strong that no matter what life throws at them, it's going to endure, and they're going to be able to give advice. Their children are going to follow their good example and with, you know, with difficulties and everything else. But that gives me a lot of hope.
Yeah. I'm going to make sure my husband hears that last part.
Yeah. Sometimes I've had this question, you know, it's a very, very talented fellow who has, you know, a degree from Harvard and he's done all kinds of things. He was asking me, well, I'm going to start paying attention to my kid when he's 2 years old, because at that time, they already make the use of reason, or they start thinking of names and they react to it. And I said, no, you get it all. You got to start today, day one, when they're born. You got to be there for them, your wife. You got to feed them. You got to hold them. You got to, you know, help them to discover the world, give them the Bible. Because the challenges are stronger than ever, but also the solution is stronger than ever, which is to form this bond within our families from the very beginning. There's a lot of research that has been done about this, and it's wonderful. And also not to be enclosed upon our own families, but to be open to helping other families. I see the network of families in many, many cities in this country, in many parts of the world, how they help each other. And sometimes it used to be the extended family played that role, but now families are so spread out that many times these friendships taking the role of actually they're almost families. The way they help each other when there's a baby that comes or when somebody gets sick and they bring meals or they make phone calls. Sometimes it is truly amazing.
Yes. Oh, lovely. Great. Thank you so much for sharing all of your experience, your own story. This is very special. Can you please share with us just a little bit about how we can, as listeners of this podcast and just Catholics and anyone who really desires to form a stronger devotion to this beautiful title of Mary, Mother of Fairest Love? Do you have any suggestions for our followers?
Yes. So, and this is one of the reasons why I joined my friends in the Fairest Love Family Project to do what we're doing, is because I experienced growing up that love and affection and just wholesomeness and meaning in my own family. I remember my mom teaching me how to sing the Salve Regina, for example, prayers to Mary. And she told me, you know, when I was young, the nuns in my school taught me to do this. And I've always been very devoted and loving of our Mother Mary. And I learned myself from my mom, you know, mostly. So the first thing that we need to do in the family, not the first thing, perhaps, the first thing is to feed our babies and make sure that they are clean and, you know, change diapers and all that. But on that human basis, after that human basis, we also need to teach them the value of life, the value of our relationship with God. We depend for everything. Mm-hmm. Even though we are so sophisticated in the 21st century, we know how to do so many things, we still are clueless, you know, about the meaning of life. Why am I here? Where am I going? What happens when I die? What does it mean to bring a child into the world? Mm-hmm. All of these answers are best answered. All of these questions are our best answered in the Catholic faith, you know, mm-hmm. in our relationship with Christ, with Mother Mary, our mother. And Mother of First Love is a particular vocation that St. Jose Maria wanted to bring to light, you know, and put on a pedestal, or, you know, because he knew that the world needs especially good families, families that learn how to love each other, how to forgive each other's defects, and knowing that nobody's perfect, but they're still believing one another. And we're going to persevere in this. We're going to stick with one another as husbands and wives, as children, as siblings. And the vocation of Mary, Mother of First Love, reminds us to pray to Mary for that intention, especially to strengthen our families. Because in family is where we first learn to love and to realize that love is huge. God loves me. That's why no matter what life throws at me, I can make it. But also in that, in turn, I need to love the others. That's what God is asking, you know, love myself, love the others, especially the members of my family, discover each one's personality. And then it goes on with your friends in school, and then your friends in the neighborhood, and then the people that you know from your work, and all kinds of situations, even those that you think are your enemies, right? I mean, it doesn't make sense for a Christian to have enemies, right? Mm-hmm. We have to look at people. People have different backgrounds, different opinions, and, you know, we have to pray that everybody eventually discovers the truth and the love God has for each one of us. Mm-hmm. That's why I think Mary, Mother of First Love, is so important.
Perfect. Thank you. Thank you, Jael, for being on the show and just sharing your story. It was really, really an awesome conversation. So thank you so much.
I'm sure if we asked you or anybody else who is a normal fellow, they also have tons of anecdotes and experiences in life. And we'll find out about all of them once, you know, we are in the other life. So
yeah, that's great.
It'll be a great get-together up there.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Fairest Love Podcast. In 2025, we are continuing to share the beautiful devotion to Mary, Mother of Fairest Love, while providing practical tools and advice for parents, couples, and families. You can help us with this mission by sharing this episode with a friend, subscribing to the podcast, or leaving a review. To learn more, visit us at fairestlovefamilyproject.org.